From the Sky News Centre at 5, a retrial has cleared footballer Ched Evans of raping a young woman. The ex-Wales striker spent 2.5 years in jail after his original conviction, but today a jury took just 3 hours to find him not guilty. Evans, who's always insisted the sex was consensual, sobbed and hugged his fiancée in court. And in a statement read outside, Evans said he's overwhelmed with relief.
Whilst my innocence has now been established, I wish to make it clear that I wholeheartedly apologise to anyone who might have been affected by the events of the night in question.
Essex police are investigating after a dog killed a 4-month-old boy and left his 22-month-old brother with life-changing injuries. Officers have confirmed the animal involved in the attack has been put down. It happened at a house in Colchester yesterday afternoon. These people who live nearby are shocked.
And you think, oh, well, that can't happen round here. What happens is at the top of your street.
They can get jealous and they can turn as quick as anything. I don't think a dog should be in a room with children.
They're lovely dogs. They're so placid. So it's not one. Wondering what happened to the dog to turn it like that.
A judge has approved a new inquest into the death of a soldier at Deep Cut Barracks 21 years ago. Private Sean Benton was found with 5 bullet wounds to his chest during training at the base in Surrey in June 1995. Up to 7,000 workers could get payouts from Asda. It's after a group of women proves an employment tribunal that mostly female shop staff were paid less than the mainly male workers at warehouses. Asda insists the jobs are very different. MPs say they want to question the former head of the inquiry into child sex abuse over claims she used racist language. Dame Lowell Goddard, who stepped down in August, has denied the claims. And the boss of Nissan says he's confident the UK will remain a competitive place to do business after leaving the European Union. Carlos Ghosn has visited Theresa May in Downing Street to talk about tariffs which could be placed on the UK when we leave. That's the latest. I'm Emma Jones.
Yes, it's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Cabinet Member for Housing and Labour Councillor for Central, Paul Smith. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, he was suspended without pay last week from the University of Lethbridge in Alberta, Canada, after someone shared a Jewish hate post on his Facebook page. Professor Anthony Hall is one of the world's experts on Native American history, an author of Earth into Property on the privatisation of America by the colonists in the Indian Wars. But he's also an outspoken critic of the official narrative of 9/11 and teaches students the war on terror is nothing but an excuse to undermine international law, so the US can invade any country it feels like. So we hear from Anthony Hall later. Also, rents on a ratchet, with housing benefits increasingly going to keep buy-to-let landlords in clover. The great housing debate. Shelter reported back in April that 8 million people are one payday away from an eviction order. Crisis say a homelessness duty in England, as exists in Wales, would cost £44 million a year nationally, but save us £46 million in costs local authorities have to pay to help the street homeless. Every mayor promises to sort it out here in Bristol. So is Marvin Rees? How is he getting on 5 months into his term of office? If he hasn't got things moving by now, will he ever? Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 and dry. This weekend, highs of 16 Celsius, sunshine and showers throughout the weekend. Next week, highs of 16 Celsius, plenty of sunny spells during the week. And next weekend, that's the 22nd and 23rd of October, highs of 14 again, sunshine and showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Cabinet Member for Housing and Labour Councillor for Central, Paul Smith. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
Tell us,
I'm Martin.
Tell us a bit about your portfolio then, doing housing. Anything else?
Well, my portfolio is homes and communities, so I'm responsible. It's all my fault for all of the council housing in the city, the work to...
How many council houses do we have?
Well, we have 28,000 homes within the council housing stock, 1,500 of which are leaseholders, so they might not consider themselves to be council tenants anymore. But so that would give us 26,500. When I was last on the council, we had over 40,000, and at its peak, Bristol had 51,000 council homes.
So where did they all go?
Right to buy. So people have bought them. A lot of the people who bought them have now sold them on. Some of them are now in the private rented sector. They're still there, most of them, but they're not in the social housing stock anymore.
Now, I can remember back when George Ferguson was first elected, he said he was going to make this a major priority. He was saying basically all the same things that Marvin Rees has been saying. What makes you think that this time things may change?
In terms of
building houses and actually increasing the number of social houses in the city?
Well, firstly, what I would say is, although George spoke about housing, the entire focus of his administration was on, one, the Metro bus, and secondly, getting an arena built, the George Ferguson Arena. And therefore, all the top officers who would be involved in development and pushing schemes forward were focused on the arena. And we saw housing development in Bristol collapse. We have made housing our top priority. We're directing resources at it. So far, I've released land for 1,800 homes, including for 200 council homes and about 500 rented housing association properties.
So where is that land? Why weren't homes being built on there, or why weren't people planning to build homes on there before?
Well, a lot of these sites have been earmarked for housing for donkey's years, but as I say, all the officer time and capacity was being directed at building an arena, whereas we're directing that capacity at building housing. So that's the difference. I mean, and it's not just, you know, it's not just George's fault. I mean, when I was on the council before, I left the council in 1999, there were plans to build housing on Hengrove Park. I come back on the council this year, there's still not a single house on Hengrove Park. So it's a failure of successive administrations. We're now taking plans forward. We're consulting with the community on building 1,000 homes on Hengrove Park.
But don't people want to keep the green spaces green?
We've had discussions with people in Hengrove.
If you remember, there was a whole Gary Hopkins business where he wanted to build on the parks.
Yeah, well, I don't want to build on parks particularly. I mean, Hengrove Park is an airfield. But the discussions we're having with people is, yes, they want a park, they want green space, they want a high-quality green space, but also the vast majority of people in that area are saying to us, we understand and accept that there will be housing as well. What they're interested in is the right balance and to ensure that they do get a quality green space. And that's the discussion we'll be having with that community over the coming months before we put any concrete plans forward.
Well, we'll be talking about this more after the 6 o'clock news, probably around about 6:20. Your community side of what you do, is that to do with things like the neighbourhood partnerships, which are these meetings around the city where people can come to and get involved in local decision making?
No, what it's about is about ensuring that the interventions we make on housing create balanced communities. And what we've got in Bristol is very unbalanced communities. So we've got areas with huge concentrations of poverty. We've got other areas of huge concentrations of wealth. We've got to look at how the interventions we make in housing within the city try and rebalance
that. Okay, well, some would call this social engineering, wouldn't they? Why is it necessary?
What's wrong with social engineering?
Well, why is it necessary? Why this sort of thing?
Well, what we want is more balanced communities. For instance, if you take Hartcliffe, where I grew up, where there's a huge council estate, the population has dropped back. There's been problems with sustaining the shops, local garages, local pubs, and almost all of the pubs have closed because there isn't enough money in that community. So there's two things that can be done. One is obviously to make sure that the money that exists within the city is more fairly distributed, but the other is also to try and bring more people into those communities and people who have got some money as well, so that there's a more balance, so that we don't have areas which have just got huge concentrations of deprivation.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, I suppose this is something you would probably agree with as well, there does seem to have been, I suppose from the time of Thatcher on, this idea that, well, the market will decide.
Yeah, well, it wasn't the case in the 1950s when we had a Conservative government which built the largest number of council houses. And it was actually well understood across the political spectrum in Britain at that time that balanced communities were what we wanted. We didn't want to end up like Los Angeles with the wealthy living 20 kilometres away from the poor and all the rest of it. And in actual fact, if you think about the high density housing in London, for example, and in Bristol, it was quite common for quite wealthy people to live, you know, literally walking distance from relatively poor people. And that actually made the community work. And of course, if you throw away that balance, you know, that balancing act over time, you get ghettoisation, which is what we've had.
Also, Marvin has done what George Ferguson has been doing over the years. And just last week, he did his State of the City report, or his kind of speech he does up at the university. And I'm going to just play a clip from that now, where he talks a little bit about planning. We're going to have a listen to some of the stuff about housing after the 6 o'clock news, Paul. But now let's have a listen to Marvin's vision, I suppose, of the city skyline here.
Last week, I came to work at City Hall and was met outside by a demonstration against the biodiesel-powered generators. This came as a surprise because only a few months ago I was campaigning against them myself in my election. I asked for an update and found that we were recommending them to the planning committee. I asked on what basis. It's our policy. Whose policy, I asked? Because it's not mine and I'm the mayor. That's one of the first real entries into the weird and wonderful world of planning in Bristol. One that sits above all of us, our managers and our elected politicians, that we must get a hold of. There are local and national policies to consider, but my first port of call is to overhaul the local policies to make sure it delivers for Bristol. Now, this sounds like red tape, but it's become clear to me this is how you start to draw your own picture of the city. And on planning, and by the way, I want Bristol's skyline to grow. Years of low-level buildings and a reluctance to build up in an already congested city is a policy I'm keen to change.
Sounds like maybe downtown Manhattan here in Bristol, Paul. But I mean, the point here really being is the planning system is incredibly boring. It's very grey. But I mean, it is important, isn't it, to get your head around it if you're going to make changes in the city.
Absolutely, and to take more control of it. I mean, a lot of planning policy is dictated nationally, but where we can, we want the policy of the planning division to reflect the policy objectives of the administration. Now, I mean, that, to me, that's what democracy is about. Obviously, the planning committees are made up of councillors from across the spectrum, and they make the final decisions. But very often they're told, you have to agree with this because it's policy, even though every single councillor on that committee is against what's being put forward. And the planning system doesn't really work in the way that local government would want it to.
Can you give us an example of this bonkers kind of planning policy you're talking about there? If you've got local elected people saying, no, this is the wrong way to do things, and yet they're being told they've got to.
Yes, well, I mean, we had the example of building 750 student housing units on the BRI just recently. Again, the planning officers were proposing acceptance, but the committee is voted against. And the even more stark, really, is the situation where you've got lots of developers putting forward housing schemes with no affordable housing in them. The committee wants to oppose it, but they're told, well, you'll be taken to appeal and the appeal will be granted. And not only will we not get what we want, we'll also have to pay for the pleasure of the appeal process.
It's almost like a kind of blackmail, almost.
Well, that's quite a good description.
Okay. Well, we'll be talking much more about this after the 6 o'clock news, as I said. Let's look at some of this week's stories anyway. And I think we've got to start really with this Bob Dylan winning the Nobel Prize for Literature, Martin. This is about time, isn't it, really?
Well, I remember his classic line, go tell your ma, go tell your pa, our loves are going to grow, ooh-ah. If that's not literature, I don't know what is.
Well, it doesn't sound like a great example. But anyway, Paul, what do you make of this the announcement yesterday?
Well, it, it, you know, obviously everybody is listening to Bob Dylan now. He's the top man on the radio broadcast. It seems to be. It's not until you're past your best that suddenly people recognise you. I guess he's just lucky that he's not dead.
There's a lot of the rest of them are from that era, certainly. There's also that famous picture of him on the old ferry going across to, I don't know if people have seen that, going off over to just, you know, before the Severn Bridge was built, back in the late 1960s, in the mid-60s. Great picture of Bob waiting for the ferry there. But I think it's about time, isn't it, that this guy was given a... And also, a lot of the commentators have said, oh, well, you know, nothing he's done in the last 30 years is really worth listening to. I totally disagree with them. I suppose I should be about to play one, but I don't have one handy, but he's done quite a lot of really good stuff since.
Yeah. I think Joe Strummer really should get one.
Well, he is dead.
I know.
Yeah.
Well, he'd really like it, you know.
How could he like it if he's dead?
Well, because he was ironic like that.
Oh, right, OK. Certainly we're big fans of The Clash on this show. I mean, back when we used to do music on here, but in the early days, maybe we should again. We used to play...
Well, music's now literature.
Apparently. Right, hard Brexit or no Brexit are the only options, says the EU Council President Donald Tusk. The European Council President has dismissed chances of any kind of soft exit from the EU, Paul.
Well, there's going to be a lot of posturing, isn't there? You head towards a negotiation. I don't really think we should take any notes of what anybody says at the moment, but it would be quite useful to know what it is we're trying to achieve.
Well, he's basically saying if you want to stay in the single market, then you're basically going to have to stay in the EU.
But there are countries in the single market who aren't in the EU. Obviously, they're in the European Economic Area. But it is possible to be in one and not in the other.
What's your position on all this then? Do you think that there should be a vote in the Houses of Parliament? Do you think there needs to be a second referendum?
I think we have to see what the deal is when we get back and where the Marmite fits into it. There may need to be a way of gauging public opinion, because I think people voted, obviously, by a majority, although not in Bristol, to leave the European Union. But they weren't actually voting for something. They weren't told what the alternatives were. And I just wonder how we sort of have some symmetry in the democratic decision making about voting for whatever.
Yes, they were. They're voting for Britain outside the EU, for the situation as it was before the early 1970s, I suppose.
But I wonder if we're going to get something in front of us which says, these are the options of the different types of being outside of the EU, which one do you want?
Most of MPs may well be anti Brexit, even though the people voted for it.
Yes, and?
Yeah, well, I mean, it means... If they may... Do you think it's okay for MPs to overturn the referendum decision?
Well, I think we're caught in a position now where it's feeling that we can't overturn the referendum decision. Although the referendum was advisory, it wasn't supposed to be decision-making, but I think the political consensus seems to be that we're accepting it. But we really do need to know what we're getting instead. Are we going to become the 51st state?
Well, that's another point, isn't it? Maybe the Americans are happy. Actually, Obama was saying he didn't want us to leave. What's your crystal ball in the next few years? What's going to happen with this?
I don't know. It does seem to be being kicked into the long grass to a certain extent. When anybody gives a date, they're told off for giving a date without it being very clear. Who knows? I mean, I'm a Romanian and would want to stay in. I'm getting my papers ready for my dual citizenship as an Italian, so that I can stay in the EU even if the UK leaves.
So, a Ramona?
I'm not moaning.
Martin, are you a Ramona?
No. Mm-hmm. I don't moan.
Yes, you do. You do it every week on here for the last however many years. Look, what's your take on what Tusk is saying anyway here? Tusk, I suppose I should call him.
Well, he's responding to what happened at the Conservative Party conference, where May gave a fairly clear signal that she doesn't want to accept free movement of labour. And then in that case, then obviously the position of the EU bigwigs is going to be, well, you can't stay in the single market then. But I think there's a very substantial segment of the Tory party, the City of London, the CBI, they want to remain in the single market, as do most Labour MPs. And it is the case that Norway and Switzerland are in the single market, but not in the EU.
Well, let's see what Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May made of it at Prime Minister's Questions. Back again, hooray, this week.
Jeremy Corbyn!
Mr. Speaker, the member for Broxtowe said there is a danger that this government appear to be turning their back on the single market, which was indeed a commitment in the Conservative Party manifesto. Yeah. The reality is that since the Brexit vote, the trade deficit is widening, growth forecasts being downgraded, value of the pound down 16%, an alliance of the Chamber of Commerce, Confederation of British Industry, British Retail Consortium and Trade Union Congress have all made representations to the Prime Minister demanding clarity. Is the Prime Minister really willing to risk a shambolic Tory Brexit just to appease the people behind her?
What the Conservative Party committed to in its manifesto was to give the British people a referendum on whether to stay in the European Union. We gave the British people that vote. They have given their decision. We will be leaving the European Union, and in doing that, we will negotiate the right deal for the UK, which means the right deal in terms of operating within and trading with the European market. That's what matters to companies here in the UK, and that's what we're going to be ambitious about delivering. Yeah.
Well, see the phrases she used there, operating within and trading with. So, in other words, she's trying to fudge it. But what Tusk and the others in the European Union are saying, you can't fudge this. If you want to end free movement of labour, you will have to leave the single market. And, of course, that's basically making it absolutely clear to them. There is no deal that we're going to offer you where you can control labour movement and stay in the single market. And, of course, the Tories are trying to pretend that they can have their cake and eat it. And as Donald Tusk says, try buying a cake and eating it as it's still there. And there's no cake on the table. All that's on the table is salt and vinegar.
I've never understood why you would buy a cake and not eat it. But I've never quite got that. But, you know, in terms of the housing situation, 12% of construction workers in this country are Polish. And we do need foreign labour in this country, or to very rapidly train British labour up.
One of the this is actually from last month. Bank of England admitted it had had its sums wrong about post-Brexit Britain. The economic Brexit bounce was made official as the Bank of England was forced to admit it had made too negative about the financial impact of the vote to leave the European Union. So there seems to be mixed messages coming from the financial people. But more importantly, this week we've had this debacle between Tesco and Unilever. Actually, I'd say an amazing PR victory really for Tesco. A lot of the other supermarkets were preparing to stomach these price rises coming from Unilever. Unilever is one of those companies we don't hear about very much, but has a great deal of power and influence on us, Paul.
Yeah, well, I mean, most of what goes on in the world is controlled by about 10 companies, but they're 10 companies you've never heard of, and Unilever is one of those. And, you know, they work on the brand of their products rather than the brand of their company.
So quite a lot of things which are kind of household names are controlled and owned by Unilever. The way that this has been settled, Martin, does look as if Unilever were pulling a bit of a fast one here, saying, well, because of Brexit, we're going to put all our prices up by 10%. And as Tesco have quite rightly pointed out, well, quite a lot of these products aren't even made outside Britain.
Yes, the Marmite War, which is made in the West Midlands from waste from breweries. The Unilever, the tussle itself is representative of what's going to happen. When you've had a 16% drop in the value of the pound, we actually import far more than we export. And that means that costs for everybody are rising, not necessarily for Marmite, but for other things. And at that point, the question is, how can you pass this on to the consumer?
Well, and this is an example the market of power a of fantastic amount of the stuff that is being consumed here and being distributed by Unilever, put nice little labels on by these guys, is actually being brought in from abroad now.
Well, indeed. It used to be the case that something like 80% of a JCB was produced in Britain, but it's now about 35%. So the supply chains stretch all over the world now from Britain. And this is one of the things that will happen if we leave the single market. There will have to be more bureaucracy, because each British company will have, if it wants to sell into the EU, will have to have certificate of origin for all of the components of the stuff they've produced to show that it's been produced either in or outside the EU. So if you leave the EU and you want to trade with the EU, EU bureaucracy actually increases rather than decreases.
Paul, yesterday HSBC quietly, although it wasn't really trumpeted around our mainstream news headlines, was warning of a
severe global market crash as well. Global Banking and Financial Services Institution, HSBC, and Criminal Money Laundering Bank, I would add to that. If you look up, they have some serious fines over in the United States, has issued a red alert for an imminent sell-off in stocks worldwide. Warning, I imagine people will be buying houses if these stocks are sold off, Paul. The price of housing will go up even higher. Warning, the markets could see a crash as big as the 1987 Black Monday. Murray Gunn, who's the head of HSBC's technical analysis team, warned the bank's clients that there could be a severe fall in stock markets given the price action over the past few weeks. Now, Martin, we had this flash crash, didn't we? But yeah. Really, I want to hear from you, Paul. What do you make of this possibility that HSBC is sort of waving in front of us now?
Well, it used to be a Trotskyist thing to wait for the collapse of capitalism, but now it seems to be that finance companies take it in turns to predict that the market's about to collapse. My guess is, you know, one of them will be right at some point, but we don't know which one and when.
I think what's been happening in the financial markets since 2008 is what we should have been talking about over the last few years. And Brexit is, in fact, and discussions about Brexit are a diversion strategy. People think they understand Brexit. It's actually fearfully complicated.
But Martin, this is water under the bridge. That decision's been made. What we need to know is HSBC right about this?
Yes, and if, fundamentally, yes. Hmm. And so I think that's what we should have been discussing, what Philip Hammond should have been answering questions at.
You've been saying this for years, years. But it's not happened.
The point I would make about that, Tony, is a crash, by definition, only happens once. But the possibility of a crash...
Well, it happened in 1929, didn't it?
Yes,
so it's happened before.
And it happened in 2008. Now, the fact is...
No, it didn't happen in 2008.
No, it didn't happen in 2008 because the state... Well, it depends on the definition of the word crash. But what happened is the state all over the world stepped in and propped up the financial market, thus creating the bubble which we've been living with ever since. Now, what we should have been discussing is, blimey, the financial markets are insolvent. We should have been discussing that all along. Insolvency, insolvency, insolvency. And what are we going to do about it? But we haven't been talking about that because we've been talking about things that people find easier to discuss about Brexit. Brexit seems to be managed.
So what do you would you be discussing then? Since you're pointing the finger at all these people who've been discussing the
wrong thing. What I would ask the Chancellor of the Exchequer is, what is your plan B for when what HSBC says is going to happen happens and there is a further crash?
What would your plan be, Martin?
Well, what we should have done in 2008...
What should we do now?
We won't do anything now, it's too late. What we should have done in 2008 was we should have had an orderly bankruptcy procedure of the commanding heights of the economy.
Okay, so how do we do something now?
It's too late.
Nobody wants to hear it's too late. Mm. What we do need is we need a plan to deal with it.
Nobody's prepared to... The reason why we haven't got a plan to deal with it, although I hope that the Treasury have got a plan, because in 2008, if you remember, they had to stay late at work and had to bring curry in...
Getting overtime.
While they came up with a plan. Now, I hope that Carney and others on the financial side of the civil service have got a plan B, but of course we haven't been talking about it because the presumption is that we don't need a plan B.
You better have your fingers crossed on Mark Carney, because I don't think he necessarily has got a plan B. But anyway, Paul, what do you make of all this?
Well, obviously, Martin's the economist, not me. I am an astrophysicist. But it seems to me that you know, what happened last time was there was a financial crash, the public sector filled the gap, now the public sector is crashing and it won't be there again. So I'm not sure what the plan B is.
Is it feasible for the Treasury to intervene and to basically... I mean, because we already own large parts of RBS and Lloyds. I mean, surely the government could just say, well, actually, we're now going to make sure that these two banks serve the public as a utility, holding money and distributing money, rather than just allow the system to collapse.
Well, the last Labour government was keen to stress that they weren't going to try and hold these banks to use as a strategic lever, that they were going back into the private sector, they hadn't been nationalised. And the problem is, if the public sector had been beefed up at that point and we'd invested in infrastructure and skills rather than bailing out the financial services sector... I mean, we bailed out the financial services sector as an emergency measure, and you have to do that.
Martin, I think we all know we've got it wrong. What we need from you is, how do we put it right?
Well, I'm afraid we're not going to be able to do anything until there is a crash which undermines the Tory government sufficiently so that they fall and more sensible people take power.
Okay, well, that's an interesting way of looking at it.
That's the only way it's going to work.
At Prime Minister's Questions again this week, we had Vernon Coker talking about, I mean, everybody is looking at, well, a lot of people anyway, looking over to Port Talbot in Wales, hoping that the jobs in the steel plant manages to remain there. But apparently there's one reason why it may not.
Vernon Coker. What does the Prime Minister say to British steelworkers who've lost their jobs or whose jobs are threatened, given the news that French steel is to be used for the new replacement Trident submarines? Is that what she means by being a party of the workers?
Yeah. Well, I have to say to the Right Honourable Gentleman that we recognise the concerns of British steelworkers. That is why the government has been, under my predecessor, and is continuing to work to ensure that we can do what we can to promote and encourage and retain a steel industry here in the United Kingdom. A number of measures have been taken. If he was in the chamber earlier, he'll have heard my honourable friend setting those out in Scottish Questions.
If we can't use British steel to make government programmes like the Trident submarine, Paul, what's the point in trying to keep hold of Port Talbot?
Well, exactly. I mean, we do need, if we're going to try and keep these industries going, we actually have to give them some purpose for existing. Otherwise, we might as well just get people to build mountains out of steel just for the sake of keeping them open. So, yeah, that steel needs to be deployed. Otherwise, economically, it's just a sink.
Martin, why are they building these Trident subs using French steel rather than British steel?
Well, because the arms industry, of which Trident is a part, is a complete stitch-up. It's not actually a market of any kind. We could have be cheaper steel to buy Chinese steel, but then since we're pointing the missiles at the Chinese, that wouldn't make a lot of sense, would it? So, in other words, the whole thing about the military-industrial complex,
so I suppose the
is
French,
there is no competition.
The French is a halfway house.
It's all divvied up.
The French is a halfway house, maybe, between expensive British steel and cheap Chinese steel.
Indeed.
And they might sell us steel which kind of goes crack or something, mightn't they, if we're building Trident subs with it?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a big question about why we're building Trident subs at all when we've got loads of people homeless and we need some houses built. Mm. Some of them could be built with steel frame buildings, dare I suggest.
Quite a lot of buildings are steel framed, aren't they? Also, staying with...
We're building more timber now.
Are we?
Yeah.
Hang on, that doesn't sound
that's
like...
That's a bit old technology.
That's a good idea. Yeah, tell us about that. Why? Why?
Well... Because of their environmental efficiency, also, you know, the speed in being able to build, and also that, you know, timber frame is becoming more popular. It's quite common in lots of other parts of Europe, and it's more flexible in many respects.
Well, it's Scandinavia because it's nice and warm. But hang on, I've got two things to say to you.
It's nice and warm in Scandinavia.
Well, because wood is warm. Yeah. That's why they have wooden houses in Scandinavia. But also, they don't last anywhere near as long. They could catch fire. And what about the rainforest?
Do you know what? I quite often go into the middle of towns with those Tudor buildings that have only managed to last for 500 and 600 years.
Yeah, well, I mean...
You know, how long do you want them to last?
I mean, timber buildings do burn, don't they? Whereas steel and stone and concrete ones don't.
They can burn. I mean, if you look at most of the major disasters we've had with buildings, it's tended to be with concrete and steel. Look at the Ronan Point.
What was that?
That was a tower block that caught fire.
Okay, well, I think if it was built of wood, that tower block might have caught fire even worse, Paul, I hate to say. Anyway, look...
It can be treated.
On to another story. UK has the worst quality of life in Europe, if you believe that. That is in the Independent... The Guardian, Mark King, just the end of last week, survey of 10 developed European countries puts UK at the bottom of the pile due to high costs of living. Well, that's your department again, I suppose, Paul. But, Martin, why is it that this is, you know, is so... The cost of living in Britain is so high, do you think?
Well, I mean, the cost of living, quality of life question is quite subjective. So, you know, some people have a quite nice quality of life in Britain and others have
but
quite
it
a miserable
to do
life.
With disposable income, isn't it? If you've got a little bit of money to spare, I mean, the trouble here in Britain is that we're finding that our rent and our electricity bills, etc., are so high and we're not getting the income in to pay for
it's
them.
It's also other things, more intangible things like... The breakdown of community. We were talking earlier about having balanced communities with different social levels mixing together and so on. We've had a devil take the hindmost strategy for over a generation, and the hindmost people have suffered as a result. I mean, real wages for the people on the bottom rung have been constantly pressed downwards, and they weren't that great to begin with. So, you know, and that leads to things like family breakup, substance abuse, etc., etc. And over time, if you think back to the 1980s when this destructive process began, it's been long enough for whole generations to grow up who've known nothing different.
Paul, it's not just about money, though. Variables such as VAT, the cost of essential goods, are in there, but also lifestyle factors such as hours of sunshine, holiday entitlement, working hours and life expectancy. France bagged the top spot for the third year running, despite families earning an average of £31,000 there, compared to £38,000 here in the UK, and working longer hours. But the French enjoy 2,124 hours of sunshine, have an average retirement age of 60, and receive 36 days of holiday a year.
Yeah, let's go to Europe and live in the sunshine. Mm. Or maybe we could move Britain south. We can't change the weather, but I think fundamentally there's been quite a lot of research shown that, you know, that it's not the absolute level of wealth, it's the disparity between the rich and the poor which has a big impact. And what we've seen, we've been hunting an American economic model, which actually makes people in this country unhappier. There's a correlation between the gap between rich and poor and the mental health of the country as a whole, which affects surveys like this. And Martin's absolutely right. We've had almost a generation now where, although we keep being told how the country's wealth might be growing, the GDP might be growing, what we're seeing is that the benefit of that is not being spread amongst the population of a whole. So they see their income's not rising very much, but the costs that they've got, and therefore their disposable income, being squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. It's quite miserable if you don't think there's a way out of that. And, you know, if that's been going on for 15, 20 years, you probably don't.
Well, I think you're referring to the study, The Spirit Level, by Wilkinson and Pickett, which was very influential. And it showed that even poorer countries, which have a more equal income distribution structure, are happier than richer countries with a more unequal distribution. Mm. And in the final chapter, they suggest the reason for this is that we are, in fact, pack animals like dogs or chimpanzees, and we are status conscious, which is what makes the arguments for competition so overwhelming in our society. But on the other hand, just as anybody who's ever run an infant's birthday party will know, everybody has got to leave with a prize, otherwise there's ructions before tea time.
I always wondered what Martin did at the weekend.
Yeah, well, occasionally I do go to infant birthday parties, but the point is every mum knows that that's the case. Mm-hmm. And it's all very well having a competitive society. In a way, it's almost inevitable. We're competitive creatures. Mm-hmm. But the opposite is also true. If people are not included, everybody's unhappier. And it shows in the Spirit Level, they've used lots and lots of stats from all over the world, and they show that even wealthier people are unhappier in more unequal societies, because they're constantly looking over their shoulders and wondering why they're not even wealthier than they already are.
Perfect, Martin. Talking of looking over your shoulders, clown sightings in the UK. Clown carrying machete is seen peering into a driver's car. Police have promised to take action against those causing fear. This is in the Independent, article by Luella MacEffethrew-Smith. And the killer clown craze continues to spread across the UK from America, as incidents involving people dressed in clown masks causing fear and upset on the streets are on the rise. One man in Manchester claimed to have seen a set of clowns on the street, with at least one carrying a machete. Well, this is just hearsay, but certainly the Greater Manchester Police, their Assistant Chief Constable Karen Hankinson, said, "We're aware of this menacing craze, which originated in the USA, and will take action against those who are causing this fear." Well, some, Paul, say that this is being spread through social media, things like Facebook, that people are encouraging others to do it. What do you make of it, anyway?
I think he's got... I mean, I've never really been that keen on clangs, I have to say. But, I mean, I had this text from my son's school on Tuesday. With recent... This is about the school Halloween disco, when people go dressed as werewolves and vampires and like. With recent press coverage, children should not dress as clangs for the disco on Friday. A phone call will be made to parents to collect their child if they come to the disco dressed as a clown. I think we're overreacting.
Well, I mean, I think these kind of crazes. I remember, I don't know if you remember clackers. People you have to, you know, but they were banned in my school when I was about 13 because they were dangerous. They used to split, and you know, shards of plastic could go in people's
conkers.
Well, even conkers can be dangerous if you're not careful.
No, but there's a psychological element to this, which is completely different to what you're saying there, Martin. Which is people, and many people do find this whole thing rather frightening. The idea seems to be to try and spread. It's actually an organised thing to spread fear in society.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, if somebody's got a machete in their hand, whether they're a clown or dressed in a sober suit. There's a question about what they're doing with a machete, isn't there?
And also, it seems to be coming from the USA. I can remember reading, this is, a long time ago, but it was the Operation Gladio, the NATO soldiers who were coming in to supermarkets with machine guns, with carnival masks on. And so I suppose at least we should be pleased that some of these clowns have only got, you know, got machetes and not machine guns. But the psychological effect is what I'm trying to get to, Martin, here. This is has a big effect. I mean, we're talking about it now. Possibly we should just be ignoring it. But, you know, it does have an effect. And the psychology is to spread fear.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what's nasty about it. If it was just a bit of fun, like people chucking ice buckets over themselves, which is potentially dangerous and silly, but at least it was not as... This is deliberately... You can't frighten people without frightening them, can you?
What about this American...
They're not laughing when you've...
What about the American connection, which even the police are saying this is coming from the States?
Well, it's coming from social media in the States as the home of social media. These kind of... All sorts of negative phenomenon are out there, we know, on the internet. And people can pick up on these things. Crazes happen. This isn't a very pleasant craze, is it? Because, you know, sometimes people can be shocked. Somebody in Wales jumped outside a primary school dressed as a clown in order to try and terrify the little kids. I mean, that's not really social behaviour. That deserves an ASBO. And don't forget, clowns are supposed to be figures of fun for children, not something that they scream and run away
from. So why were clowns not figures of fun for you, Paul?
I don't know. I wouldn't say I had a phobia, but I've just never really found them particularly funny. They always look a bit spooky to me. So, you know, I'll be staying well away from clowns, whether they're killer clowns or comedy circus clowns.
The NHS is in crisis all year round. A&E targets have been missed as hospitals are now facing winter pressures in the summer. NHS England data shows key targets have been missed in hospitals during August. Nearly 2 million attendances at A&E in August 2016, an increase of 3.6%. This is in the Daily Mail this week. Nearly 6,500 bed-blocking patients are currently stuck in hospital, and levels are at their worst on record, Martin. Now, look, this is getting deadly serious. The NHS is running out of money. We've got 6,500 people actually in hospital, even though they're ready to go home, but then there's no care programme for them, so they have to stay in hospital.
Well, that's because of cuts to social services, which is dealt with by local authorities, and they are the Cinderellas. I mean, the Tory government feels that they can offload the cuts onto local government because local government is not necessarily controlled by them, and the bad results of all of that then gets... their political opponents then have to pick up the pieces. And also, of course, the NHS, they claim that they've been increasing the funding, but then the population's increased, so they're not increasing...
Well, more and more money that goes into the NHS is not going to the NHS, it's going to financial institutions that have been financing these PFIs. That is a Labour Party idea. Brilliant Labour Party idea, apparently.
Well, it wasn't a Labour Party idea, it was originally a Tory Party idea, but the Labour Party carried it along with
enthusiasm. The last Labour government really kicked off the whole PFI programme in schools and hospitals.
No, you'll find that it was It was kicked off by John Major.
Okay, so, yeah, but it wasn't actually really implemented much by the John Major. It was the Labour Party that really kicked Paul. Anyway, what do you make of these figures we've got this week?
Well, I mean, I saw some figures recently show that two-thirds of health trusts were in deficit. which is shockingly worrying. And what they're doing basically is crisis management, because there isn't the proper investment in community care and social care, as Martin says. So what we've seen is the NHS trying to take beds out, because beds are very expensive, on the basis that there will be all sorts of support for people in the community to help them live in their own homes. But what's happened is that the rug's been pulled out from underneath them, because, you know, one of the largest cuts over the last 5 years is the cuts in things like home care, which is almost like the invisible services. So while people will take to the streets to defend libraries, quite rightly, they're not taking to the streets to defend things like home care, because it's not so visible as a service. And so local authorities have tended to hit those services, and we've also got an ageing population. So there is a real crisis in the health service, which is partly fueled by the crisis in social care.
Well, what about the Labour Party's responsibility for this by being such a cheerleader for PFIs?
Well, I think actually what we're, you know, whilst there's an issue about PFIs, and some of them left us in quite a difficult position in some areas, the real problem has been the cuts in public services and spending since 2008, and particularly since 2010.
Well, we're now faced with a £2.45 billion deficit this year in the National Health Service.
Yeah, it's absolutely shocking. And as I say, the NHS seems to be allowed to build up deficits and then hopefully get bailed out. Local authorities have to balance their books by law, and therefore the cuts in social care are never bailed out.
Oh, so that's actually this difference legality between what the NHS can do. So that, I suppose what we're seeing here is that the council, as it's having to cut services, is constantly pushing people towards the NHS because it knows the NHS is allowed to go into debt, whereas it's not.
I don't think that's the case at all. I think, but there is a problem of people being able to be moved out to services that don't exist from the beds that they're in, and then making it difficult for people who need beds to come into the health service.
So when are you going to spend enough money on home care to allow these people, thousands of people who are in hospitals, to actually come out and go back home?
Well, it's home care is only one of the services. Well, when we're allowed to actually raise the money to do it. I mean, what government does with local government is it gives it responsibilities and at the same time reduces its money. And, you know, it just doesn't work.
How many Marvin Rees flights to America or to Brussels can we cut in order to make sure that maybe 10 or 20 people get home care?
I mean, a lot of those have been funded. Marvin's been seeking external funding for some of those things, and actually been able to get it. But fundamentally, if you cut the complete cost of the mayor and didn't have a mayor at all, you're not going to fill the gap in the social care budget.
This also was brought up a couple of times actually this week at Prime Minister's Questions, the problems with the health service.
Meg Hillier. Yeah.
Mr. Speaker, the Public Accounts Committee and the Controller and Auditor General have both warned that the NHS budget is not sustainable. When is her government going to wake up to the reality of growing demand and avoid the political rhetoric and set a sustainable NHS budget for this year and for the future?
The government took a very simple approach to this. We asked the NHS themselves to propose their 5-year plan for the NHS. We asked them how much money they required. They said 8 billion. We're giving them 10 billion, more than the NHS said. Funding in the NHS is at record levels. The only place where money for the NHS is being cut is under a Labour administration in Wales.
Well, this is political point scoring, isn't it, really, on both sides. The NHS is in a difficult situation because they've not given it enough money, even though they say they've increased it. It's still not enough. And when they say, we've spoken to the NHS and they said that they wanted this, which NHS are they talking to? As Paul's just pointed out, 2/3 of trusts are in deficit.
And of course, there shouldn't really be trust at all, actually.
You're saying the NHS is in difficulties. Dr. Mark Holland, president of the Society of Acute Medicine, said the bed blocking crisis is causing the NHS to be locked in an eternal winter. He said the NHS is on its knees, and this winter areas will implode around the country. There is no reserve left.
Well, that's because they've been cutting the social care that's required to clear those beds, and because they don't want to give local authorities the money. NHS has got relatively soft budget constraints, so you can imagine people running these hospitals presume they will be bailed out, just as Southern Cross was bailed out, which was running old people's homes. You shouldn't have a situation where fundamental infrastructure like hospitals, schools, etc. can go bust. You should set up a scenario where it's planned properly. I mean, she was talking about a five-year plan there. Five-year plan? What does that sound like? Oh, that sounds like something that used to go on in the Soviet Union.
A lot of people are pointing their fingers at local authorities here, saying, well, look, you know, you've got to look after people at home and the elderly. The crisis, apparently, according to this article, is being fuelled by a lack of social care funding, as you were saying, which means elderly patients cannot be discharged from hospital. Care has not been set up for them at home. And we're coming back to the same thing. How is Bristol City Council going to sort this out to make sure people do get care at home?
Bristol City Council is not in a position to sort it out. It hasn't got the resources to do it. And as you know, it's had a quarter of its money taken away from it. We're looking at, over the next 5 years, taking out £500 million from Bristol City Council. It cannot do it, whether we want it to or not. It just hasn't got enough money. And in terms of the funding on the health, the issue going back to the worst quality of life also showed that the spending per head on health in the UK was one of the lowest in Europe. So it's not been adequately funded.
Police are threatening legal action over the lack of mental health beds. This is late last Friday, this article popped up on the BBC website. The chief constable said he has made it clear, the local NHS bosses, that the current situation is not acceptable. Chief Constable has vowed to stop unlawfully holding people with mental illness in police cells because the NHS has no beds for them. Sean Sawyer, Chief Constable of Devon and Cornwall Police, wrote to Devon Partnership NHS Trust to say it will be held to account in future. The letter leaked to the Express and Echo said legal action may be taken if the situation is not resolved. The Trust said it was disappointed but accepted more needed to be done. He said while it was unedifying to sue a public body, he would do so if necessary, Martin.
Well, I mean, what we're seeing here is a kind of pass the parcel, isn't it? So you don't fund social care sufficiently, so that then creates a crisis in the NHS, so they then don't have money to deal with mental health issues, and then the police then end up picking up the tab, so their budget is then overrun because they're dealing with lots of mental health issues, which is not really their role. And what happens is people end up pushing these things around, hoping that somebody else will deal with it, because there is insufficient resources. Meanwhile, of course, we're still bailing out the financial services sector years after the financial crisis because they deserve the money.
But what he's saying is the number of 136 detentions where people can remove someone they believe to be mentally ill to a place of safety is reduced, but the current situation is unacceptable. He claims beds are not being made available effectively, speedily or efficiently. If someone comes to harm, technically I'm holding them in those cells unlawfully. Detaining a mentally distressed person in a police cell for days is not acceptable in anyone's book.
No, it's not. But, of course, the police end up with the people in the cell because there's nowhere else for them to go. And that's because the resources have not been made available to deal with the issues concerned. Meanwhile, of course, we're still building Trident. We're still bailing out the financial services sector. We're still going to build HS2. We're still going to build Hinkley Point. We're still going to build all of these white elephants. And money's no object when it comes to that.
Paul, is it right for the police to consider suing because the local NHS trusts aren't looking after mental patients and they are having to?
I don't think it's the answer, but I can understand the frustration. I mean, the approach that's been taken in Bristol by Marvin Rees is to bring everybody together through the city office that's being created to try and look at how the services can be joined up better.
So what is
so
this,
that rather than what, passing the parcel, we're trying to share the cake.
What is this city office then?
The city office is, I mean, it's a name, but it's basically a bringing together of all of the public bodies, many of the voluntary and private bodies as well, to say, can we find a way of working together to find a sort of whole system solution to a lot of these problems? Are there ways in which by swapping resources, sharing resources, we can actually achieve a better result than what's happened here in Devon that you've described, where the services start blaming each other.
Well, we haven't finished quite with the NHS yet, I'm afraid.
All a sheriff.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I previously worked in an NHS service which the Coalition Government gifted to Virgin Care, who are now seeking another contract covering my constituency. Amongst many unethical practices I witnessed, Virgin imposed a system of double appointments, forcing patients to have unnecessary extra consultations before surgery, boosting their profits at the expense of the taxpayer and of patient safety. Is this acceptable? And if not, what is the Prime Minister prepared to do about it?
Well, of course, what we want to see in the provision of local services is the best services possible for local people. But the Honourable Lady talks about outsourcing of services in the NHS. I have to say to her that the party that actually put greater privatisation into the NHS was not this party, it was the Labour Party.
Well, Theresa May rejoicing there, pointing the finger at Labour, and she's right, actually, Martin. We were talking about this earlier, this whole idea, for example, of bringing Virgin Care in to do NHS work. Well, they're looking at having several appointments, for example, with patients, so they can make more money out of each one.
Well, that's the argument against privatisation, but I don't think Margaret Thatcher thought that way. And, of course, the Labour government should have knocked all this on the head when they were in power. They didn't, which is why we've had a rebellion in the Labour Party against the Labour leadership.
Why didn't they, Paul?
Well, your guess is as good as mine. I mean, I think the marketisation of health services is absolutely the wrong thing. If you actually look at, for instance, the American system, which is, you know, which is what we could end up with if we're not vigilant, is incredible amounts of financial waste, lots of money going into finance institutions, lots of money into administration, and a much less efficient service. The NHS as a public service is actually very efficient, and that's the way we should be keeping it. We should be moving away from this marketisation.
Clean coal firm claims the world's first commercially viable zero carbon power plant is a game changer. This is a coal-fired power station. Ian Johnson in the Independent, their environment correspondent, writing here, Martin, this week. A revolutionary technique to capture carbon emissions from coal-fired power stations has been shown to work on a commercially viable basis for the first time. It's an Indian company that's doing this. So does it mean, do you think, we might start seeing coal-fired power stations, a bit of Welsh coal being used again over here?
Well, let's just say this technology is viable and they've managed to crack it. It won't make much difference to us because we closed our coal industry down during the Thatcher Revolution, so we're never going back to her because it's too late now.
But Paul, that coal is still down there under the Welsh Hills, isn't it?
And also, I mean, we do share the environment and the atmosphere with the whole of the world. We're not in a bubble. And if this technology, carbon capture and storage, is successful, it really, I think, it is a game changer. We have to see whether, you know, it doesn't use more energy than it takes in, but you know, I'd be interested to see how it operates. And you know,
I'll put a link up to this,
but we have
article.
Got plenty of coal here still.
I put the link up to this article on our show page, thisweek.org.uk, so you can have a look at that one. Finally, we've just about got time. Windows 10, Microsoft should pay compensation for user upgrade woes. This is Which magazine. I don't know if either of you have had any problems with Microsoft Windows 10 upgrading itself when you've asked it not to. No, Paul?
No, I haven't got Windows 10.
They've been pestering me, but I've been resisting. But apparently, even if you resist, eventually it downloads itself onto your computer and wrecks it. I've heard very, very bad stories about it.
It does, yeah. It's basically
Brexit back into it. No?
It's upgrading itself, and that means that various things on the computer then stop working, like your speakers, your microphone, your webcam, and you haven't had any choice as to whether to actually be upgraded or not. That's the most frustrating thing about it. The answer is get Ubuntu, Linux, or some sort of open source system, which you can then get Windows to sit on top of and actually control it. But anyway, I'm going to have a go at that over the next few weeks with my laptop at home.